You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
From Shakespeare to Schwartz, from Fosse to Alvin Ailey, from Sondheim to Bareilles, from McNally to Fay, it happened to the greats, it still happens every day. When lightning strikes, it's the moment you know. When lightning strikes, where you're meant to go. You can stand and shout Eureka, do whatever you like. You'll never forget the moment when lightning strikes.
This is Gerald Brunner, and you're listening to When Lightning Strikes, where we talk about the tingly, heart-stopping, mic-drop moments that led you to becoming an artist. Martina Mayoc is a fiercely talented playwright who won the 2018 Pulitzer Prize for Drama for Cost of Living. Her newest play, Sanctuary City, from New York Theater Workshop, is now playing at the Lucille Lortel Theater. Her plays, including Queens and Ironbound, have been performed throughout the United States and abroad. She studied playwriting at the Yale School of Drama and Juilliard School, and she's currently writing two musical librettos and developing an original series and film for HBO. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks so much for being here. I love your work and so much congratulations on the recent opening of Sanctuary City. How does that feel? You're just off your opening. You got incredible reviews. What was that like for you to birth this play?
I still kind of am in disbelief that it's actually opened. You know, we were shut down during the pandemic. And so this sort of 18-month, there was this 18-month pause during which our set was still up for that entire time. And there was like, we'll come back. At some point, maybe. But I was like, will theater be back? I don't know. A lot of uncertainty, and then the hurricane happened, and we were like, "Is the theater gonna flood?" Just wondering. I've been holding back, been guarding my heart, and now that it's open, I'm in a strange shock. It hasn't settled that people are actually able to see the play now. Yeah. It feels really good. It's just also strangely like tentative shock.
I know, it's also surreal to be back. I feel like we're tiptoeing back into the water, and it's really special to be in the theater to get again all at once. I love in his New York Times review what Jesse Green said about Sanctuary City. He said, "I've rarely seen a play that so effectively embodies the way external forces, in this case, immigration policies in the United States, distort the inner lives of actual humans. What love is and can ever mean is lost in the muddle between the heart and the law." I just think that's so beautiful. Can you talk about that, about the immigration experience, how you... in your play, how, and it's so much more, and yet so embedded in the characters.
Yeah, I think I've tended to write personal stories or stories of people that I grew up with, or stories of my family that end up being, there's an inherent politics in them because of oftentimes who they are. If it's if you're an immigrant to the country, you've been affected by immigration law. And for the friends of mine who were undocumented, obviously it's affected, like their status has affected the opportunities that they have access to throughout their whole lives. And there's another aspect of one of the characters that is a surprise later on that is also affected by policy. So I feel like I never set out to necessarily write political plays. It just is inherent in the circumstances of the characters. Not that I shy away from it. So I will have witnessed what happens to the lives of people, and then try to kind of go backwards, I guess. So I then research afterwards everything that sort of I write the play first, and I kind of double check to see if all the sort of legalistic things are on point. I had two immigration lawyers check the script just to be like, "Is this okay? Is this does this all sound right?" And thankfully, it did. I come from I grew up in a largely multicultural immigrant neighborhood in New Jersey, and so everybody was from somewhere else. Like, that was my experience of America when I immigrated.
From Poland, right?
Yeah,
you immigrated from Poland. Poland.
Yeah, yeah.
When you were five, right? When I read.
I often say as a child.
Oh, okay.
only because I think but yeah, five. But like the reason I say as a child is because I felt like there's like a feeling of not being enough, like that not being enough of one thing or another, that sometimes people have defined. They'll define by an age. Oh, well, that means that you're American and therefore you're not Polish, or that means that you're this or that. And I've struggled with that because it feels like it doesn't give me a chance to like define, you know, sort of who I am. I think I've talked to other like kind of first gen and other like immigrants who've come over young, and a lot of us have this sort of strange feeling of like almost shame for coming over young, because it's like we kind of can't claim it. My family's all still back in Poland, but I kind of just identify even more so as like immigrant American, I guess.
I understand. Well, at its core, your characters are so humane and three-dimensional. And I want to talk about your lightning strikes moment when you knew you had to be an artist. When did that pull or those pulls come to you?
I think I was always drawn to storytelling. Actually, and as well as like drawing and painting, I think the sad truth, I guess, or just the truth is I as a kid, because of the sort of domestic situation that we were in, this sort of a volatile home, I would often like close myself in my room and do quiet activities that were, you know, writing, that were drawing. And it wasn't that I was escaping in them, but it was a way to keep me safe. When I began writing, plays in college, I was trying to understand kind of what is certain paradoxical human behavior. Like, why would somebody do some of the cruel things that they do? And I would sort of go backwards from those actions and try to collect it in dialogue and action to try to try to better understand other people as well as myself. And then discovered that one of the things that I loved about writing for the theater is I had to be every character. I had to be everybody. And so nobody could be a villain. Nobody could be, you know, just a victim. It was like, it let me, like embodying their consciousness, like, I guess helped me to, have a closer understanding of other people as well as myself in ways that I think that we don't allow ourselves in regular life. Like, we hide from our own selves. And I think I can, the place that I can actually be truthful with myself is through writing and through then developing it with actors.
Do you remember some of the first things you wrote though when you were a child?
Oh, they were horrible. Yeah, they were like 3 hour long like skits and things. I used to work for an adult literacy program in the high school where we would teach immigrant parents and their preschool aged children English together in an after school program. And the goal was like to provide them with muscle memory language. So if they were going into a bank or like a cafe or something, they would have the language ready to like, you know, ask for what they needed. And so we would write these skits and have them translate into various languages. And I would write the skits, and like they just got more and more elaborate. Like, there was a murder heist at the bank, and like there was like an affair at the cafe, and the like head of the program was like, they really just need to know how to order a sandwich. Like, it's not like, clearly you have like, you need an outlet. So that's sort of how I started. But then in college I was writing my like, you know, 3 hour long emo plays about really bad. But you gotta start somewhere.
You gotta start. Was that at the University of Chicago?
Yeah.
And then I read that your the first show you saw was or the first Broadway show you saw was Cabaret.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were 18 or 17?
Yeah, 17 or 18 is some it was like my last year of high school. That on a total like fluke that I ended up in it, at the theater. I had won $45 playing pool, and I decided to use it toward something I never would have used it toward had I come about it legally. My mom was a house cleaner, and she would bring home like pamphlets and magazines from her job that people were ready to recycle. And there was a pamphlet for the then Roundabout's production of Cabaret, which I guess at that point had like substituted John Stamos for Alan Cumming. And yes. To my mother, that was like Uncle Jesse's in New York. And so she gave it to, she's like, is this of interest to you? And I was like, oh, tickets are $45. And so I decided to go see that. And I guess it changed everything.
How did it change everything? Hard to articulate what that did to you, that impact of seeing.
I think it's in addition to being in a room where human voices are filling the space with so much life. It was a story that is, I guess, you know, arguably you'd call it a pretty dark story. It's quote unquote tough subject matter, but it was told with such humor and bawdiness and joy, and there was an actual literal invitation in the, you know, at the beginning with Wilkommen, that I really responded to. And it wasn't compromising what it was about, but it was still inviting. And so there was something about that I've like taken as a lesson for how to approach the act of making theater, which is like to not shy away from the truth, which can sometimes be difficult, but also to invite people into it, because the goal is that we're coming away with a deeper understanding of what it is to be human together.
That's what I love about your work. you don't shy away from the truth. You don't sugarcoat. You know, you see people in a very raw state and connecting in a very raw human way. That's really satisfying, you know, or gut-wrenching at times, but so real. Yeah. Did you have a sense though of when you were a kid, even when you were writing those skits, that God, this is the way I need to express myself. This is a path for me.
No, I don't think I even really understood what a playwright was. I guess I had always been drawn to art making and, whether it was writing or drawing art I was drawn to making, and but I was also in conflict with my like immigrant kid logic of, oh no, this is not the goal for me is to become like a doctor or a lawyer, to try to pursue not just like social escalation but safety. Like for us it was just make sure that you're going to be okay financially, that you'll, the idea of like, my mother wanting a better version of life for me than the one that she felt that she was able to access. And so, I was scared to pursue anything in the arts because I knew how, it was a gamble. So I think maybe I would have pursued it earlier, but I fought against it, especially in college. I felt like in high school was a thing that I couldn't help. I guess it continued. It was a thing I couldn't help doing. I kind of continued doing it and I couldn't help it. And then found myself like, oh, I think I'm now an English major. Oh, I think I'm just in the theater all the time. I'm in the library, like reading plays instead of doing the assignments for my other classes. Like my body was telling me, was like fighting with my logic brain of like, yeah, clearly you're pulled toward this. So maybe try to pursue it. And then it was this battle with myself of permission and encouragement.
When did the playwright heart win? And get, is that when you got to Yale or before? How did you get to that path to go to Yale and study?
Well, it was because I made a pact with myself that the only way that I could pursue play, I was writing I'd written, I think, my first like big full-length play, my like junior, senior year, and I had it was such a fulfilling experience to write it and to share it with other people. It was difficult, but it was also like, I think I'd never felt that like transcendence in living. It was sort of the best way that I could just describe what it felt like. There was something very special in this that felt like, oh, I'm more alive in pursuing this. I had won an award. I applied for and won an award for immigrant students that was called the Mirage Foundation Fellowship for the American Dream, which it provided $10,000 a year for 2 years, so $20,000 total for students that are graduating from college to, like, quote unquote, pursue the American dream. And for me, it was like, I want to be a writer, which meant that I only had to work at the bars part time and I could use the rest of the money to pay rent and like spend the other half of the week at the library and writing and teaching myself playwriting by reading all these plays and figuring out how they work, by seeing shows. And this was in Chicago. So it was also just like the cost of living there was lower. It was more possible for me to access the theater there. And through that award, I think I was like, oh, if somebody pays me to be a playwright, then perhaps as long as somebody's paying me, then I can be a playwright. So that was a sort of pact that I made with myself. And I found out what graduate schools had free tuition and had stipend and health insurance, which to me was like, ah, that would be payment. And I applied to those, got into Yale, and kind of continued doing that with applying for fellowships and applying for opportunities that, like, there was some external validation coming my way of like, it's okay, you can do this. I'm paying you. There's somebody paying you. And I think I still have that.
Follow the life insurance.
Yeah,
I get it. Yeah. How did the experience of going to Yale change you as an artist? And you know, was that like playwriting 24/7? Not 24/7, but around.
I mean, basically, but yes.
Yeah. I mean, like this very singular, delicious focus. You know, let your playwriting heart lead you. I don't know if that sounds lofty, but
it truly is like of the body. It's like heart versus mind. Like the mind is saying, this is not good. This is not the logical thing you should be doing. It's and my heart and body are like, but I can't leave the theater. I love it. I'm in the library all the time. I think my first year of Yale, I was still like expecting them to be like, just kidding. We're sending you back to the bars of Chicago to go continue being a cocktail waitress. So it took like a year to be like, I think I'm going to get to stay. And then it was what I loved about it the most was the people that I got to meet, as well as what felt like a safe place to fail. I think I needed to risk in a place to stretch and learn and risk in a place where I wasn't going to be judged. Like the reviewers were not coming to see my school productions, but I needed to have the experience of being in a room with actors and talking to a director, which I hadn't had before. So it was invaluable for me for that, for sure.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
And I want to go back for a second to that transcendent experience, the third year of when you wrote that. What was the play? Can you talk about that play?
It was the play called Wander Standing. And and it was, no one's ever seen it. And I don't even have it, I don't think. And I hope nobody does. I hope nobody else has it as well.
So it wasn't put on. Nobody.
Oh, it was.
Oh, it was. That's right.
At the University Theater. And I didn't know I didn't realize that like a playwright could be in the room. I thought that they just like gave the play to a director and then they put it up. I had no idea. So I then came in later and saw what my play was, and I was like, oh no, I'm not sure that this is what it's meant to be. And it was a learning experience of, even though I thought there was humor, or, and I endeavored to have humor, but I think people were reading the subject matter, which a lot of it was, you know, autobiographical, and so it had like domestic violence and things like that throughout it. But because it had those subject matters, I think there was an idea that it should be like very depressing and very difficult and uninviting, actually, which I think is the thing that I was, you know, I had been trying not to do, and to realize that I'd have to learn how to better articulate my intentions and also be involved. And once I started being involved, I realized that's the part that I loved the most was like, once I'd written something, I don't actually like writing. I like being in the room with, no, I find it very difficult. I avoid it. It's rare that I'll get into a flow state where the ideas are coming and it feels really exciting, but even that is difficult. Maybe because accessing some of those things are just difficult to have to look at. But when I'm in the room with other people and we're all working on something together and we're collaborating and we're all trying to create a more true version of the story, that's the place where I truly feel most alive. And this spark with other people, sharing their stories and responding to things that I might not have realized were in the play, or realizing there's something missing here, and then talking about what that might be. And then I get to discover some sort of key to the rest of the play. It's just such an electric, lightning strikes, it's such an electric thing. That's like I'm addicted to that. I think I truly feel like I'm addicted to that process. And it's what's kept me in the theater.
Do your plays transform quite a bit then when you get into the collaboration, when you get into the rehearsal room, or,
I tend to be an underwriter. So what ends up happening is I will have thought that something is is there that actually isn't. And so it takes other people asking questions about a moment and then less sort of digging in deeper. So rarely is it that like something is, I'm rewriting in the sense of making something completely new, but usually the sort of container of the play will stand. And then it's just like unearthing, like, you know, archaeology, paleontology, whatever you want to call the things that are actually there but are kind of under the page.
Mining.
Mining's better. and also finding what else is there, hopefully. or finding what else might be there because an actor might have noticed a connection between something that happened earlier in the play and later, and then that will illuminate something and include that. So it's just, I just love that so much.
That's so cool. How did you go from Yale and Juilliard to getting your plays out into the world? How did that happen?
Well, I graduated Yale in 2012, and then it just continued my let's apply for every fellowship and everything that might have financial security, I mean not security but something compensation to it for playwriting, and I applied to Juilliard because it was a place that I knew I could get health insurance, and you know, Marcia Norman was there at the time, and I really wanted to I just wanted to be around her and kind of get her wisdom. I'd like read her essays and her talks, and I really looked up to her, and so I wanted to be with her. But also, it was like a free program that had health insurance, and I think it was my might have been my first year at Juilliard. I think I entered in 2015, that I had my first production of Ironbound, but in New York. Before then, I was just sending out the play to every place I could find. I would look up theaters whose work that I really responded to, and I would reach out. I would read playwrights' bios to find out what opportunities they had, so that I could then see if I could apply for them. It was just scrappy, survivalist. Like, what can I? Where can I? How can I get into this community? So it was through a lot of, I think, reaching out, and then finally somebody responded, and the play actually was done in Chicago in 2014, then it was done in DC in the summer of 2015, and then finally it was done in New York in early 2016. So they've all, I mean, it took a while. I think there's the second play happened much quicker. It wasn't even finished and it was programmed, but there was, I think, maybe like a tentativeness of a new, I was a risk. Mm-hmm. It's a new person, mm-hmm. a new voice, and nobody knows who I am. So it took a little bit of time for whatever reason, but that took a bit, and then it was a little easier after.
The second play was The Cost of Living. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love this, another quote from about Cost of Living. Again, Jesse Green, but he said in the New York Times, it would be a mistake to see Cost of Living as an identity play about people with disabilities. Rather, it's a play about disabilities with people. In both of its stories, which eventually collide, the biggest handicaps are the universal ones, fear and disconnection. Woo! What inspired Cost of Living, and what do you think about what Jesse said in that quote?
I was so happy that he saw what the intention was. It was never meant to be a play about people with disabilities. I have no authority to write a play that is about an identity of somebody that is not like to say that I'm writing an identity play I feel like I have, like, I struggle with my own identity. So to like take an authoritative stance on identity was not the intention at all. But it was largely a play about class and about loneliness, that happened to also have two disabled characters, that happened to also have two first generation, immigrants and, two people of color. I mean, but it wasn't, that wasn't, yeah, that sort of wasn't what the intention of it was. The play started as this opening monologue, where I had been, it's my first year in New York, and it was a really difficult year. I lived in 13 different apartments. I was like bed bugs. New York hazed me. They like sent the locusts out. Very difficult to like get my footing because of just not in the city, because of not having enough money. One night I got fired from my bartending job because they thought I stole $100, which I didn't, but later on I wish I did because I still got fired for it. And it was this January, blizzardy January night, Saturday night. And at the same time, while I was struggling financially, wondering like, is this something I should be actually doing with my life? This was during a time when one of my closest family members had passed away suddenly in Poland, and I wasn't able to see to say goodbye or to attend the funeral, also because of money and also fear. I just didn't want it to be true. And so I was in this state of like hoping that I would see his ghost. There'd be something that like reached out from the beyond, and like communicated with me. And I think I was like seeking miracles. I was really, it was like a strange place of grief. So all of that kind of collided that night. And I began writing this monologue Eddie Torres's monologue about, you know, being at the bar and getting a text from his deceased wife. And then I put it away. It was like, I just felt like this was just for myself. Like I just kind of went into a drawer, and a few months later I was writing about, I was asked by a theater company by Ensemble Studio Theater to write a play about employment. The theme was employment, and so I wrote a short play about when I used to work as a personal caregiver for two men with disabilities in Chicago, and I one of them was very similar in age to me, and so I wrote this, you know, a sort of imagining interaction between two people that were similar to us. And then later on wrote like another play, short play that I realized was it was in the same voice as that first monologue that I had written. And then there was connections amongst those three small disparate pieces. And because it was such a difficult year, and I wasn't like, I was able to sit down at a desk and say, I'm writing a play. It was sort of all I had were these pieces, and I thought they might be speaking to one another, and decided to see what story they might tell together. And then for the rest of the year, kind of worked on trying to crack the code of what they were trying to say. And it ended up being about, you know, care and loneliness. It sort of feels like a Rorschach test of like that year and a half of my first year of New York.
Oh, all that pain and then to be able to capture that in this beautiful play. And you're, I mean, the two people who are differently abled, mm-hmm. they're not very sympathetic. I mean, they could be real jerks sometimes and complicated and that's what I love. And that they're just so flawed, like all of us. Yeah, and then their relationships are really complicated with their, yeah.
Well, it feels, with the others. It feels distancing when people are seen as either too saintly or villainous. And so it just seemed like, everybody is a character, everyone's human, and they, and also, you know, have identities that that separate them, but in arbitrary ways from other people, because, you know, somebody has said that you're different. But like, mm-hmm. I'm just writing human beings who happen to also their identities and their backgrounds inform who they are, but it's not the sole aspect of them, that feels like me to, everyone's human.
Yeah. And struggling. Yeah.
And specifically for disabled characters, I had found that, there were sort of only, there were mostly two narratives that I would encounter about disabled characters. And one was like the savior kind of inspirational character who was there to inspire other like able-bodied people. And the other was the dying with dignity narrative, where somebody was fighting for their right to die. And I just felt like there was just a wider range of experiences that perhaps should be featured for actors with disabilities than those two.
That's so great. And how did winning the Pulitzer change you when you won? Or did it change you?
I bet it didn't. I thought that it would fill the like gaping hole of sadness I thought that it would fix the, like I maybe it was the whole like seeking external validation. Oh, this is pursuing awards or pursuing like somebody else telling me that I'm enough, and like, of course I'd always dreamed of a Pulitzer. Like once I found out what it was, I was like, oh my goodness, like this is like an indication of you are good, you are enough. And when I received the news, disbelief was the first, like, certainly somebody's like pulling my leg and this is a joke. My agent actually was the one who told me that I had won, and I was for 10 minutes on the phone, I was yelling at him. I was so angry that he would play this joke on me, like truly angry. And he's just laughing. And he's like, why don't you give it a minute and like see if I'm actually joking. And then, you know, elation, so happy. Like it felt wonderful. And then I realized, oh, it didn't necessarily, it didn't fix the things that like somebody else giving me that kind of validation didn't necessarily make all my problems go away and make me feel like I was enough. And I found that to be a positive thing because it meant that I'm not done. It meant that there's still a drive to continue telling stories. And it actually isn't about the awards. Like they're wonderful. Yeah. They do mean a lot. They mean so much, but there's something I think potentially deeper about the drive to tell stories with and for other people that I loved was still there. So I guess it's a complicated relationship with it, but very grateful and very happy about it.
And I love how you're branching out that you're writing two librettos. So you're adapting The Great Gatsby for the Broadway stage with Florence Welch and Thomas Bartlett.
They're writing music and lyrics, and I've written the libretto, and they have I think about 20 songs thereabouts. So I'm going out to London in January to do another workshop. I just came back from our first workshop, which was also like, you know, it was very, very COVID. We took a lot of precautions. It was this rehearsing and workshopping a musical with a lot of people during COVID is not uncomplicated. We're going back in January to continue working on it. But it's been really lovely. It's been wonderful, and the music sounds fantastic. And so yeah, I love just listening to it on the subway. So I'm like, oh, this is a good sign.
Have you written musicals? Have you written books for musicals before? Is this something brand new for you? Or
I guess this is my second one. I had tried to write one before in grad school that sort of never came to be. And then I have another one that is the memoir of Girl Interrupted. That's a little bit less that I can speak a little bit less about, but it's so that was technically, I guess, the first one that I did outside of grad school, and now this one.
Because I know you
a lot. It's just cool to like have another collaborator that early. So and like I'll get these songs texted to me or emailed to me, and I'm like, oh, it's just magical to be able to. Music is just magical. If I could do music, like that's, I would trade playwriting to be able to have the ability to like, to move a soul the way that music does.
Yeah. What is the quote that if you've nothing more to say, you sing, and if you've nothing to say, you dance. But, and were you always a fan of The Great Gatsby? And what a fascinating source. What fascinating source material to bring to a musical form.
I had read it in high school, I had a similar experience. I think a lot of us have had of like reading it in high school and being like, oh, okay, this guy throws parties. fine. And I think connecting with Gatsby, of this like striver mentality, but I didn't really think, I didn't think too much of it. And then I had reread it in, I guess, January, when they approached me about the project, and, it was the perfect, book to read in the middle of a pandemic in one's 30s as well. The language is beautiful and transcendent and stunning. And it's like so otherworldly. Beautiful. So there's that, but there's also this feeling of, is this really it? Is this really all life is? It's also, it's set in, a few years after the flu pandemic, and a few years after the end of World War I. And so everybody who was basically featured throughout there's two people who are veterans in the, you know, Gatsby is a veteran, Nick is a veteran. They're all these people are coming out of a moment of intense devastation, and having seen so much death around them, especially the death of younger people, and the mentality that they adopted was kind of like a devil may care, and I will, like, if I could die at any moment, I should live my life to the fullest. Roaring 20s, you know, that I was like, oh, there's something really fascinating about that time in relation to the time that we're in right now. And so I really, it was like, you know, once I read it, I told the producer, I was like, listen, I really want to do this. But if it doesn't work out, I'm just really glad that you brought The Great Gatsby back into my life. Cause it was so, it spoke to my soul in a way that I really needed. So yeah, very much a fan now. I'm obsessed with F. Scott Fitzgerald.
He's such a poet. You know, how he strings words together is so beautiful. And can you talk about your HBO projects? Or are you allowed to talk about what you're developing for HBO?
I could do one of them. But one is a film, which is a book adaptation. And the other is I'm working to adapt my play Queens into an hour long series. It's been a long journey, that's what I'm working on.
How is that different writing, you know, for TV, you know, writing screenplays?
I get to show the characters' worlds in ways that I have to ask people to imagine them in the theater. And sometimes I found is that the people in the theater seats may not have had the same experiences for them to be able to recall or easily imagine, like what it is to live in a certain circumstance. Like, I think we actually all have the capacity to understand every other human life. Like, I truly don't, like, if we're all human, we all experience love and loss and betrayal and grief. And like, so we're the same. But I think I've discovered that maybe some people are a little closed off to accessing certain other people's lives and experiences. But if you show them, this is what the world looks like, I think people are, they can, I guess, believe it more. It's exciting to show, the play is about a group of immigrant women from various backgrounds who, at one point in time, over about 16, 17 years, that at one point in time, all occupied the same basement apartment in Queens. And so what's exciting about working on for television is I can just show them in their home countries. So I can, like, when I go back to Poland with my mother, she's a different person. Like, her humor is different, like, her body is different. And so we get to sort of show that while also inviting an audience, a television audience into that, so that they get to know these characters in very different, you know, who is this character when they're working at cleaning houses? Who are they when they're like the matriarch of their huge loving family, like, in their home country? Who are they, like, 20 years in the country when they feel more established? It's a really fun opportunity to be able to expand the lives of these characters that, like, I had to condense because of just theater runtimes.
When you say when she goes home, she's her body's different. Is she more? Is she less guarded? More able to be herself? Do you find?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Who is herself, right? Like, it's
who is
she? Like, for everyone.
Who are any of us? You're
I just
right.
Think her relax a little bit more. I think she's there's something about when you can the fluency of humor, like when you can feel like you can tell a joke in a really, like, fluid, comfortable way that's like a moment of, like, seeing somebody at their most alive for me, like, what their humor is. And I think she's kind of more comfortable there. And sometimes uncomfortable in other circumstances there as well. But, like, I just remember the first few times that I would go with her and I would observe her and just feel like she's something different is happening to her body.
What's some of the best writing guidance you've received, or is there a mantra when you sit down to write a play, you go, well, I know you said it's hard to, you don't find the flow or you don't love it, but is there something that helps you get through?
I think the hardest thing has been to quiet the voices that tell you you shouldn't be doing this or you're not enough and oh, you're a terrible, terrible writer. And that's I think that's been sort of my journey over the pandemic in the past few years of like figuring out how to deal with like these sort of negative voices. And what I've discovered recently, which I don't discover, but I have like finally listened when people have been telling me this for years, is that nobody has to see your first draft. Actually, you're in a very safe space when you're writing because nobody has to see it. And so you can feel free to like be your full self in all of the ranges of like, you know, beauty and ugliness that we might contain, because you have to allow yourself you have to open the gates for yourself to let everything out on the page, or you won't ever like realize you won't ever realize the truth if you're constantly censoring and editing yourself, which I think is what those voices are do. I guess understand that you are actually in a safe, this is like pot to kettle, so like that you are in a safe place when you're creating. It's your truth, which is all of our truths that we're trying to access. And if you shut it down too early, you might never get there. And so trusting yourself and loving yourself in order to enough to like, let, you know, just speak who you are.
That's wonderful. And if for people who might not know Sanctuary City, what would you like people to know about the play?
I would like them to know it's a play about love.
Let's talk about humor and how you bring in humor into your writing, especially because a lot of the subject matter from afar can seem serious, and yet there's a lot of laughter in your plays.
It's a similar experience I had with Cabaret, where like humor is an invitation. Humor is an act of reaching out to other people, I'm never making fun. I'm never making light. Oftentimes, the people who tend to be the folks in the most difficult situation, or maybe even the most marginalized characters, tend to have other leaders of the humor. They're the ones that have the laugh lines, which is also a source of power. Is to create in another person like a laugh, like that is powerful. And because the subjects can be difficult, I make sure within the first minute there's a laugh, so the audience knows that they can, that they feel that they're invited to laugh with these characters. And also because it just feels true to these characters' experiences. It's true to my experience that it's just that humor is that is like a currency between us that is very meaningful. And so we just feel dishonest to not have that in the plays. But it's mostly it's a tool of invitation.
I love that. Was there someone when you were a kid, when you were writing these skits or writing it that said, keep going, or saw this gift that you had, who was nurturing it, who was saying, keep going?
I think in my public school and in my public high school, there were a few teachers who absolutely, you know, encouraged continuing to write. There was one time where I was like given an assignment to write two pages and I came in with 25. And this poor like public school English teacher was like, I have 30 students, like I cannot write 25 pages. But instead of being like, this is wrong, she was like, she introduced me to there was like a young playwrights competition, and I didn't know how to write a play. I thought writing a play was like you wrote a movie that you couldn't afford to make, and so they did it in front of you. Just like this, and then later on, like the English learning program, like was because I was writing skits in my Spanish class, that, and this teacher was like, would you like to join this and this group and continue writing. And so they're like, so much love for the public school English and reading teachers of New Jersey. So much love for them. Yeah. That's very little means, but they did what they could.
That was in Carley, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And what do you remember what that the 25 pages roughly was about that you wrote?
I don't. Yeah. I just remember that it was like, yeah. I was like, I remember it was the number. It was like just 2 pages, and she was just like, "That's nice. Don't do that again." No, she didn't. Who knows? But I think it didn't feel like I was doing a bad thing. But I was, yeah. I was just aware of like, oh no. Now I'm aware of like the demand on her time that I had made.
But how wonderful that she went with it. She was okay.
So much love for them.
So cool. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time and have a wonderful day. And I'm excited to see what else you birth into the world.
Thank you so much. The greats, it still happens every day.
When lightning strikes, it's the moment you know. The theme song was written by Tom McGovern. This episode was edited by Kyle Moore. And the talent was booked by Anna Stratt.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.